The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing. Not because they are easy, but
we have main engine start. 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston, broadcasting to 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good evening, listeners, and welcome to the Space Show Classroom for Tuesday evening. It is great to be here. This is April 6th, and we appreciate all of you listening. Let me tell you a little bit about our program, and then off we go. So our focus tonight on this classroom show is an overview of the U.S. launch industry and also the new space emerging and existing launch industry and its potential. And the timeline for its potential. And our guest panelist with us today is Dr. Jeff Faust. He's editor of The Space Review, which is www.thespacereview.com. If you're not a subscriber to it, you're missing out on a terrific weekly newsletter with some of the best contributions and thinking and analysis and articles from people all over the space community every single week. It's an online publication. He also has spacetoday.net, which provides links to and summaries of space news from around the web, as well as spacepolitics.com, which is a weblog devoted to space policy. He's very well known. He's published in lots of different things. He has a BS degree with honors in geophysics from Caltech, and he has his PhD in planetary sciences from MIT. And his full bio will be up on the website. In fact, it already is because he's a frequent guest on the show. And then our co-host, Dr. Jim Logan, is with us. And Dr. Logan has held many positions at NASA's Johnson Space Center since 1981, including Chief Flight Medicine, Chief Medical Operations, Chief Medical Informatics and Healthcare Systems and Group Manager, Human Test Support, Board Certified in Aerospace Medicine. He has served as Mission Control Surgeon, Deputy Crew Surgeon, or Crew Surgeon for 25 Space Shuttle missions, and was the only medical representative to serve on the NASA Headquarters Chartered Space Station Operations Task Force. His bio is up on the website as well. He also is a pioneer with telemedicine. And he's very well known. And Dr. Jurist, who will be joining us late, is a physicist and medical records person involved in business. His degrees are in biophysics and nuclear medicine from UCLA. He's an adjunct at UND Space Studies School. And his bio is also up on the website. Now, for those of you who would like to call the show today, it is area code 1-866-687-7223. Remember, this is a talk show, so phone calls are better than email and chat. And there are no call screeners. Let the phone ring until it can be answered, and we'll bring you up on the air as quickly as possible. And then if you do want to use email, those addresses are drspace@thespaceshow.com, thespaceshow@gmail.com, and dmlivings@yahoo.com. And chat is on the AOL programs, IM, ICQ, and CompuServe. The screen name is all one word for all three of those services, Space Show Chat, lowercase. It is visible and working now, so you should see it if you're using those programs. If not, please send me an email or ping me about it. And then remember that we podcast with Gigadial, and we're appreciative of Andrew for all of his services. We're iTunes compatible. Search for The Space Show, and in a host of other services, you'll find our RSS URL to subscribe on our newsletter and both of our website information places. Then also do go to our website, thespaceshow.com. Remember, our comprehensive newsletter is there. can't miss it on the website, and it has all of the events published, the full bios of our guests, and a future events section, and it's where we announce changes if we have to make any changes. So do check it from time to time. And then everything we do is archived, so you can download shows or listen to them from our website. There's a store there. It's called Space Show Gear. And then, of course, the Support the Space Show button. Remember, we're a 501c3 nonprofit with the One Giant Leap Foundation. We could not do this program without your support, and we're very appreciative of those of you who do support us. Thank you very much. And then remember also the Space Show is brought to you in part by the Secure World Foundation, promoting cooperative solutions for space security. For more information, visit them at their website, secureworldfoundation.org. And then I'm really only going to do one hold the date, because the Space Access Conference starts this week, April 8th through the 10th in Phoenix. Their website is space-access.org. You can still probably, get into it and make reservations. And if you're in and around the Phoenix area and you're not there, there's something wrong with you, because this is the place to go for what's going on in the new space industry and the related industries. Our guest panelist, Dr. Faust, is going to be there. And, Jim, you're going to be there too, right?
No, I don't think I'm going to make it.
Oh, you're not going to make it. Okay. So if you do go, find Jeff Faust and tell him you heard him on the Space Show Classroom tonight. Gentlemen, welcome to the classroom, and it's great to have you both with us. And, Jeff, I'll lead off with an overview question. What is, because of the policy announcements and, the shift that everybody's talking about, we're going to go to commercial launchers from government launchers. What really is the status, and what are the components of the U.S. launch industry?
Hi, David. Well, first of all, thanks for having me back on the show. It's always a pleasure to be on. Let's talk a little overview of the U.S. launch industry. And I think the focus for the time being is to look at just the American launch industry, keeping in mind that, this is very much a global marketplace, and a number of countries and companies are involved in the launch industry. But in the U.S., you have right now one major large provider, which is United Launch Alliance. And that is a joint venture between Boeing and Lockheed Martin that was established several years ago by the two companies to merge their separate launch vehicle ventures. Boeing has had a line called the Delta, and Lockheed Martin had one called the Atlas. And these efforts were merged together into a 50-50 joint venture called United Launch Alliance, which manages both the Delta and Atlas lines. These are the major vehicles for launching government payloads, whether they're Defense Department satellites, reconnaissance satellites, NASA robotic missions, the scientific satellites and such, and to a very small degree right now the commercial side. These vehicles aren't major players at this point in time in the commercial launch market, although they have done commercial launches in the past, and they occasionally do them from time to time today.
Why do they not do so many commercials? Is it just strictly a price issue?
Price plays one factor into it, and these vehicles tend to be not as competitively priced in the global commercial launch market compared to the RN5, which is a European vehicle, or the Russian Proton rocket, which are two of the major ones in the established commercial launch marketplace. The other is the fact that right now, given the rate that they produce these rockets, the government is pretty much taking up all that demand in terms of Defense Department needs and also to a somewhat lesser degree NASA needs. So if you were a commercial customer, even if these vehicles were price competitive, the question would be how easy would it be for you to get on the manifest for, say, an Atlas V launch? And would you have the same level of priority as, say, a Defense Department mission? So these vehicles aren't as competitive on the commercial market. They are. The Atlas V in particular is commercially marketed. It did a commercial launch last fall for Inmarsat, a major satellite operator. But you see that, you know, by and large, the Atlas V and Delta IV serve the U.S. government market at this point in time.
Okay. What else do we have for the for U.S.
Well,
launchers?
You know, we also have, obviously, talked about the space shuttle program because that is the nation's, you know, current existing human rated vehicle. We've got one shuttle in orbit right now performing a mission. As I think everybody knows, the shuttle program is winding down at this point. There are only a few more missions after the current mission. The exact number may be a little bit in flux right now because of policy issues about whether there will be maybe one more shuttle mission added or maybe several more added or maybe no more added. But there are only a few more missions after the current one on the current manifest. But, you know, this is the heritage U.S. human launch program that's been around. You know, the shuttle would be marking its 30th anniversary in a year from now, April of 2011, if it's still in operation at that point for that access. We have some developed on the small launch vehicle side. We have some efforts. Orbital Sciences Corporation has a few vehicles, the Pegasus, the Taurus, the Minotaur, for launching small, primarily government payloads. ATK is now working with Lockheed Martin to revive a vehicle program called Athena. Again, focusing on very small payloads on the order of, you know, 1,000 to 2,000 kilograms at most. And then, of course, there's SpaceX with both its small launch vehicle, the Falcon 1, and the Falcon 9, a much larger vehicle for launching both satellites and potentially in the future launching crewed spacecraft as well. And that's obviously a vehicle that's getting a lot of attention right now because it's been out in the pad at Cape Canaveral, did an engine firing a couple weeks ago. They're now looking for doing the inaugural launch at some point in May. Schedule's been slipping a little bit as many launch vehicle program development programs slip. But they are, you know, under active development and getting a lot of attention because of their potential both to reduce the cost of launching spacecraft compared to existing vehicles in its class, and also because of its potential in this new direction by the White House to open up commercial access for crewed missions to low Earth orbit. So that's, you know, in sort of a nutshell, and there are, you know, and I'm leaving out here for the time being the suborbital vehicle developments, because there are a number of suborbital vehicle developments. We wanted to focus at least for the time being on the orbital vehicle development. Because you've got, you know, a number of established vehicle programs, but also up-and-coming efforts like SpaceX, and also mentioned briefly, Orbital, besides their small launch vehicle programs, has a medium-class vehicle called the Taurus II that it's developing that'll launch from Wallops in Virginia initially for launching its Cygnus cargo spacecraft to the space station, but also potentially for other satellite missions and potential upgrades down the road.
Okay, so, and we can talk about sounding rockets later too, but a couple of questions. People always seem to be sending emails to me, and they talk about the Atlas having a very long lineage and ancestry through ballistic missile rockets from the beginning of the rocket period. What is the relationship of the current Atlas V to that famous name of rockets that were used early on both for the military and for NASA?
Yeah, the Atlas has evolved quite a bit over the years, and the Atlas V that launches today is a very different vehicle from the early Atlas rockets that launched John Glenn on his Mercury spacecraft into orbit back in 1962. The biggest difference that I think we've seen is that the Atlas V and an interim vehicle that existed for a few years called the Atlas III, its first stage is powered by a Russian engine called the RD-180 that is actually manufactured in Russia and shipped over to the U.S. for launch, and that's used on the first stage of the Atlas V. That replaces, you know, a U.S.-built rocket system for the first engine system for the first stage that had been used on the Atlas II and previous ancestors of the Atlas class. So certainly the Atlas has evolved a lot over time, and when you see notes about the long, you know, unbroken record of successful launches by Atlas vehicles, you'll realize that that dates back to around the early 1990s. That was a very different Atlas rocket. The Atlas, you know, even the Atlas II is a fairly different vehicle from the Atlas V, in large part because of that switch in main engines to the RD-180 for the Atlas V. So it's a different vehicle. You know, the Centaur upper stage has evolved at a much slower rate. It's got a lot. The Centaur system does have quite a bit of heritage dating back to earlier versions of the Atlas Centaur. But you know, it like a lot of launch vehicles, the name is attached to vehicles as they evolve, and the name that the Delta IV, for example, is a very different vehicle from the Delta II, which is a very different vehicle from the earlier Delta rockets as well, that have evolved over time. That we often keep the names on rockets as they undergo significant changes, bigger changes than you might expect that would be worth keeping the name on a rocket. But that's the way nomenclature often goes in the launch industry.
And Delta II is no more, correct?
There are still a few Delta IIs around. They're not being actively manufactured, to the best of my knowledge, at this point. But there are a number of Delta IIs still in storage that are being used, will be used for a few remaining flights over the next few years, primarily for NASA or perhaps the occasional commercial customer. For that, the big change with the Delta II is that the Air Force is now done with its use of the Delta II rocket. The Delta II is had been a workhorse for a number of medium class satellites, in particular GPS satellites, for a number of years. But as the Air Force moved to shift all of their all but the smallest satellites onto the EELV rockets, the Atlas V and Delta IV, they've discontinued their use of the Delta II, and the Delta II probably is going to be phased out over the next few years, simply because there's not a sufficient customer base, really, with the remaining NASA and, again, the occasional commercial launch to support that vehicle development at a price that people are willing to pay for that class of vehicle.
Okay, so let me ask you another question, and Jim, anytime you want to jump in, just jump in. But we've probably gone through maybe a half a dozen, maybe up to at most a dozen rockets if we include the shuttle, which is the only human-rated vehicle. And that's pretty much what the U.S. has in its launch group of rockets. So if I think about transportation in general, and I want to transport something, and I need to get a truck or a shipping company, boy, do I have choices, don't I? I mean, not only, as to brand, but as to what size of 18-wheeler or pickup or van or, I mean, you know, they're countless. And many of them I can go and rent. And so a lot of people talk about we need something similar like that in the launch industry. So we're counting rockets on basically one hand or one and a half hands. What does it take to get to something comparable to, having a whole bunch of choices for commercial as well as government users? Or do we even need that? Do we even care?
Now, that's a good question, and one way to approach that is to really look at the different classes of customers for the U.S. launch industry. And it's typically, when people do that, people typically break them down into three classes: the military, the civil government, and the commercial sector. And you can break that down to a bit greater degree of granularity. But if you look at most military customers, for example, we'll start with them, Defense Department, the intelligence community, what's typically called national security space, is that these tend to be very high-value payloads, satellites that they're developing. These are, you know, often exquisite, one-of-a-kind satellites that may cost $1 billion or more in some cases, such as reconnaissance satellites. You know, even stuff that's run off a assembly line almost in terms of things like GPS are still pretty expensive satellites, and there is a very low tolerance for failure. And that's become increasingly true because in many cases the development programs for these satellites have run behind schedule or over budget or both. Reducing their flexibility and their redundancy. And so they are very risk intolerant. And the Defense Department also is very much willing to pay extra, in order to ensure that the launch is, to reduce the odds of a launch failure. Mission assurance is what they call it. To you know, pay extra to make sure that everything is done exactly right, and you get that extra nine or part of a nine in terms of reliability. That drives up the launch costs. That makes it more difficult to use that same vehicle or that same line of vehicles for customers who are perhaps a little, a little more risk tolerant, more willing to accept risk, but don't necessarily have the same budget as the Defense Department in terms of paying for vehicles. So, because they are the anchor customer, in large part for much of our large launch capability, what's provided through ULA with Atlas V and Delta IV. You know, those vehicles are driven by those needs. What you see, the same in terms of the NASA robotic space flight, the science missions, there's also, it's not necessarily driven to the same level as the Defense Department, but there's certainly, these are often one-of-a-kind satellites that are expensive, that are often driven by very precise schedules in order to do a particular mission. If you're doing a Mars mission, you have a launch window that lasts roughly a few weeks every 26 months. If there's a problem with the rocket and you slip that launch, you are have to sit on the pad or sit in the clean room for another 2 years before you can try again. So, again, that drives a particular kind of performance from your launch vehicles. Be able to do that. So you're not optimizing for cost as much as you're optimizing for schedule assurance and reliability. Obviously, with human space flight, the same thing. You know, for the shuttle program, is not optimized for cost. It's optimized for safety and reliability. What you see, the interesting thing is that when you look at some of the commercial markets, particularly sort of the established players in the commercial communication satellite industry, the major satellite operators, whether they're companies like SES or Intelsat or DirecTV and Dish, is they obviously don't have the same deep pockets as the Defense Department, but they're also somewhat risk intolerant in terms that, the launch may cost them $100 million or so, but the satellite costs them $300 million. And it may generate several times that much in revenue. They're not going to take risks by trying to save $20 million on a launch by launching on a less reliable vehicle, per se. So what you see is that a lot of sort of the established market out there, both military and to some degree commercial, is optimized less on low cost than on reliability and schedule assurance and overall performance. So you see that sort of skewed effect on the market in terms of what the established companies and organizations are willing to pay for, and what effect that therefore, that has on the industry, and why you don't see, for example, greater launch rates, because the customers aren't necessarily launching lots of satellites, but they're launching very expensive satellites, very high-value satellites that they're willing to pay extra for to ensure that they get into orbit on close to the schedule they desire and certainly with the reliability that they demand for. So you see that sort of skewing effect, if you will, in the market versus what you might see, in some other transportation industries.
Here's your first question. This is Bob in Kansas City. And he said, Jeff, you just said something really interesting, and that is that they might not care about saving $20 million because they're much more risk intolerant and they want the reliability. How does that bode for Falcon 9 when it actually enters service? It won't have near the track record of Delta or Atlas or Ariane or Proton, yet it might be a little bit cheaper or maybe somewhat cheaper. Is the price point enough to shift market to it, or are they going to say, go build a track record first, and then we'll think about it?
Yeah. Well, if you look at the case of SpaceX and Falcon 9, which is certainly a very interesting new entrant into this market, a lot of their business right now is, for the Falcon 9, is coming from NASA with their contract with both the COTS demonstration missions to demonstrate their ability to deliver cargo to the space station, and then the CRS contracts to actually do so. And that's a big part of their contract. You don't see a lot of contracts that they have from, say, a lot of these major commercial satellite companies to launch their satellites, because they're waiting to see what sort of track record that they are going, that SpaceX is going to have with the Falcon 9. Certainly these companies are interested in saving money on a launch if they can get the same level of schedule assurance and reliability that they can get with the more expensive vehicle. They're less willing to sort of take a flyer on a new entrant until they've got a better idea of how well they can perform. What sort of reliability do they really have? If you are a major, if you look at the business case of a major satellite operator, you're spending oftentimes, several times the cost of the launch to actually just build the satellite. You have all the ground infrastructure as well. But that satellite may generate, several times its cost in terms of the revenue it's going to generate once it's in orbit. It doesn't generate you any revenue, though, if satellite fails to reach orbit. You'll get your insurance payoff, but you won't get that revenue stream. It will be delayed by several years while you build and launch replacement. So therefore, it makes it makes very much sense for these companies to decide, well, we'll pay a little extra for, a launch provider that we know has a demonstrated track record, like Ariane or Proton. Or Sea Launch when it gets back in the market because if you take the risk on a vehicle that's unproven and you get burned because it has a failure, your shareholders will not be very happy with you for doing so.
Go ahead, Jim.
Sorry.
No, go ahead, Jim.
Well, I was going to ask in the same vein. I think I'm hearing kind of a paradox here, because as you're describing it, and I certainly agree with your perspective. If the users are used to paying top dollar for a launch for whatever reason, reliability, schedule, whatever, then that makes me question whether there actually are market pressures to reduce launch costs. I mean, we talk about reducing launch costs as some kind of holy grail, but based on the way you've explained it, and by the way, I think you're absolutely right, I'm not sure there really are any market pressures to reduce launch costs.
Well, from the existing markets, you're absolutely correct. The DoD is, their top priority is mission assurance. Schedule assurance, issues like that, though, those are the highest priority over cost. The question is, are there potential emerging markets that can that may be more cost sensitive or can otherwise create some sort of downward pressure on pricing because, you know, for whatever reason they have the volumes or simply what their business case demands to be able to do to shake up sort of the status quo that we have here, because what we do have right now is something, you know, close to a steady state. It's not the most desirable case in terms of the launch tempo and the pricing and so on, but it's something that is satisfying by and large the needs of the existing customers. The question is, can you have some sort of disruptive entrant into this market that can either a new market that stimulates demand for a very different class of launch, or you have a new entrant in terms of providing capability, a company, for example, like SpaceX, that can provide the reliability and the schedule assurance and so on, but also at a lower cost that starts to make a difference in business plans for different ventures that might otherwise not get into the market under the current situation. I think, you know, unless you have that, then you have sort of a steady state that you have at the current time, more or less, that would continue, you know, without any, you know, major disruption for years to come.
Do you have any kind of predictions on what some of these emerging markets are? I mean, I agree with you on the SpaceX story. That may be a disruptor. But if there are emerging markets, what can you give us an example of what you think some of those might be?
Yeah. Well, one that's more, in fact, more of the small launch vehicle side is the effort by the Defense Department to develop something that they call Operational Responsive Space, or ORS. And this is really designed, you know, as a very different paradigm versus the more exquisite military space applications. These are focused on small satellites that would have to be launched rapidly to fill a need during a crisis. For example, you want to put more reconnaissance satellites up to look over a hot spot in the world, a North Korea or Iran or something, during a time of crisis. Or there something happens and you need sort of a gap filler replacement in an urgent period of time. You know, that's not possible under the current paradigm for military space operations, where you have big satellites take many years and billions of dollars to develop and launch. To be able to develop something very quickly to serve an urgent need for military forces, particularly at a tactical level. So when with those sort of goals in mind, you're forced into, you know, a very different approach for spacecraft, sort of good enough versus extremely good spacecraft, good enough to meet a particular need at a particular time if you can build it and launch it quickly. That forced you also to by necessity look for lower cost approaches for doing so, without the same size and overhead and relatively slow approach of big programs to be able to put something up in a matter of weeks or in the ultimate goal of ORS, even to do so in days, to be able to have a 24-hour call-up and do a launch of a small satellite that, you know, perhaps has been sitting in storage someplace, or something that you can put together in a week's time to meet a specific need and launch. And that's something that, you know, the Defense Department has been looking at for several years. There is a small office, the ORS office in New Mexico, that's looking at these approaches. It's still in the more of the research and development phase at this time, in terms of they're working on their first operational satellite at this time for launch, perhaps later this year. Do so, but if you had a situation where, you know, you can demonstrate that there is a military utility for these small satellites that can be developed and launched rapidly, you're creating a different market there at the small end in terms of providing a much higher rate of spacecraft development, for example, of smaller spacecraft, but needing, you know, launch vehicles that can be used relatively rapidly, whether it's something like Falcon 1 or the revived Athena spacecraft or the Minotaur's Athena launch vehicles, rather, or the Minotaur launch vehicles, to be able to meet those needs. So you're developing a little different paradigm to operations. And then the question that comes after that is, can that then be extended over to other aspects? Civil and commercial customers typically don't have the same sort of urgent needs for spacecraft in that class as the military is proposing. But if you've got, you know, that infrastructure set in place where you can launch, you know, small spacecraft at a low price, whether you can do so rapidly or not, but if you can do so, you may open up additional markets for civil or commercial needs for relatively small spacecraft that can be built and launched on the cheap. That's one example of a market emerging that could be disruptive at the low end in terms of the class of launch vehicles that you're using to serve this market, and in much the same way that, not necessarily much the same way, but analogous to at least some degree is, you know, when personal computers were being developed in the 1970s, people were looking and say, well, they can't do the same things as, you know, as these mainframes can do. I'm not terribly interested in them. I need my mainframes to do what I need, and at the time you did, but people suddenly found uses for, you know, relatively low-powered but inexpensive computers for all sorts of applications people weren't thinking about when those computers were being developed, and people who wouldn't have ever thought of using a mainframe computer.
So do you build these rockets on the hope that emerging markets appear? Or, you know, the proverbial question is which comes first, basically, the market or the hardware?
Yeah, and you're seeing right now in ORS they're sort of both shuffling along, you know, at the same pace, sort of looking over each other and, you know, wondering, you know, who's going to come out first, the small satellite, because there's already a number of companies that develop small satellites. You've got a number of small launch vehicles out there. We haven't quite, you know, found that. Gotten them quite in resonance with one another, you know, and build off of each other's momentum at this point. Because, you know, we've had, you know, small launch vehicles for a number of years. We've had small satellites for a number of years. I think we're seeing the technology advancing on the small satellite side, where you can do more and more useful missions in a satellite that may weigh only a few hundred kilograms or less. Thanks to advances in electronics and sensors and so on, that allow you to pack more into a small satellite to do a variety of missions. So I think you may be seeing a little bit more innovation on that end than you are seeing on the launch vehicle end. But at the same time, you've got developments like, you know, the Falcon 1, which at least in the Falcon 1E iteration that will enter service in a year or so time, be able to put up small satellites for roughly $10 million or so.
So many people think if all you did was lower the price of the rockets, the launchers that you've been discussing so far this evening, the markets would appear. But from what we're really hearing, that's not necessarily the case. The companies would probably just be leaving a lot of money on the table, right?
Yeah, it's a question of market elasticity. How elastic are these markets? And I think what we've seen is that for these established markets, that there's not a lot of that in terms of you can lower prices, but you won't necessarily stimulate a lot of additional demand. And one example to look at that is at the commercial communication satellite business. You know, this is an established, a major market for launches, and there are roughly two dozen or so commercial launches each year, the majority of which are for these communication satellites, whether they're beaming home television programming into your homes or relaying other communications or so on. It's a major established business that's been around for a long time. But, you know, the barriers to entry in that business are pretty high. It takes a lot of capital to get involved. If you're putting together a commercial geo satellite, you've got to be able to get a slot in geo for your satellite. So that involves a lot of licensing work and dealing with organizations like the FCC in the U.S. as well as the ITU to get a slot in geo to put your satellite in. And so there's a lot of investment involved. And to make the most use of those slots in GEO, you're going to probably make your satellite, you know, pretty big. You're not going to put up a small satellite in GEO that can only return limited programming. You're going to make the most use of that real estate and put a large satellite in, so that's going to drive up your costs. And so that even if the launch were free or almost free, you wouldn't see that much additional demand from that market sector simply because of all the other costs and obstacles for additional entrance into that market. So if you're looking to stimulate additional demand, you've got to look at additional markets outside of sort of these core markets, because the way that they're set up right now is that if you were somehow able to, again, you know, create, you know, a magical free rocket, you know, to serve those markets, you wouldn't see that much additional demand simply because of all the other costs and issues associated with serving those markets.
Well, so aside from responsive space, do you see any purely commercial emerging markets starting to come out, or are we still talking mostly about potential but not specific?
Yeah, and you have an interesting wording there, purely commercial, because, you know, a lot of what we're, you know, commercial remote sensing is not necessarily purely commercial, in that, you know, you see a fairly low level of demand for commercial remote sensing satellites, particularly those from companies like Digital Globe and GeoEye that can return high-resolution imagery. But a lot of these companies have major contracts with the U.S. government to buy their imagery or even help develop their satellites. So the question is that purely commercial? And, you know, if you had a commercial purity test, would they pass necessarily? Which is, it would be an interesting question to debate. But you're seeing but you're also seeing, you know, again, if we get into these hybrid, partially commercial, partially government markets, or places where governments can stimulate additional demand that can then be picked up by the commercial sector, is the delivery of cargo to the space station and eventually crew to the space station. NASA has gone down that road the last several years on the cargo side, and now with the new policies, they're going down the commercial side. The question is, are the vehicles, both the launch vehicles and spacecraft that are being developed to do that, serve additional markets? And certainly if you talk to Robert Bigelow of Bigelow Aerospace, he'll say, yes, definitely, we would love to be a customer for any vehicle that's developed to carry crews into low Earth orbit, because they have some, you know, pretty major plans for developing their own commercial space stations for commercial research, for tourism, for other activities. But those space stations aren't particularly useful if there aren't any means to get crews to and from them. So they're certainly looking at being a potential customer of vehicles that might be developed, at least initially, to serve NASA's needs for access to the space station. You have potentially, you know, the same vehicles could also be used if you're wanting to, just carry tourists up to spend a day or two in orbit and come back without docking at the space station. Potentially other commercial research applications. SpaceX, for example, has been selling a version of its Dragon spacecraft called Dragon Lab that would launch in orbit, not dock with the space station, but just stay in orbit for a period of days or weeks or perhaps months, with a series of experiments on board, and then come back home and give researchers access back to those experiments. That is something that is built upon their Dragon spacecraft for doing cargo and later crew to space station, but is serving a somewhat different market. So the question is, with things like commercial cargo and commercial crew, can the government stimulate additional markets that might otherwise not develop or develop at a much slower rate than they would without NASA's participation? And I think that is a major issue right now for the commercial space industry in general at this point in time. Is there a significant market that can be tapped in the near future if NASA does proceed with its plans for commercial cargo, commercial crew, space station to serve a particular NASA need to support that facility?
What's your best guess, yes or no?
My best guess is that in the long term, yeah, definitely. I think that at least initially, these vehicles that would be developed would be serving primarily one customer, and that would be NASA. You look at the cargo for one example. That's serving an ISS need. You can see that potentially, say, if there's a Bigelow habitat, that they'll need a cargo capability as well to deliver supplies and such to their facilities. But more importantly, they need a crew capability as well. Just being able to deliver cargo isn't going to be sufficient for their space station needs, because those facilities are designed to be human-tended, so you also need the ability to get crew to them. On the crew side, I think that if NASA wasn't involved, if NASA decided not to get involved with commercial crew at all, you would eventually see the development of commercial crew capabilities, but at a much slower rate than what we're talking about now. It would take a much longer period of time, simply given the investment needed to develop a commercial crew capability, the uncertainty in the market about exactly how much demand there would be for such a system, which would affect the ability of companies trying to develop such systems to raise outside funding for them. And certainly the technical obstacles to doing so. I think that without NASA participation, you may be talking many more years before you would have the ability for a commercial venture to launch people into orbit. I think it eventually would be developed, but at a much lower rate. With NASA in there, with both the market and the funding that they're proposing to help develop these systems in order to meet a particular NASA need, the need to get astronauts to and from the space station, you can see systems, developed in a much shorter period of time that, presumably will be flexible enough that they will not be so specific to the ISS, that these systems can also be used by Bigelow, they can be used by other commercial ventures, they can be used for a variety of other applications on top of simply servicing space station, and thus be truly commercial in that NASA will end up being one customer of several as opposed to one customer of one.
Well, this kind of begs the question a little bit, and this question may be a little too picky, but I think it's important philosophically, and that is, the thing that I'm having trouble getting my head around is that if the government is the major, or in many cases the only customer, can you even use the term commercial? I don't see the difference. People are talking about, we're just going to do these commercial solutions. But if the government is the customer, I really, quite frankly, don't see that as commercial.
Well, basically
these companies are becoming government contractors.
Yeah.
But
the same way that Boeing and Lockheed was.
Jeff, before you answer that, let me add to Jim, okay? because it begs what I'm going to ask, and then we'll take a short break and we'll come back to a bunch of listener questions that are piling up. But number one, based on what you said a little earlier, if there are commercial users for Falcon 9, they're looking for government money to test it out and make it reliable. So that sort of supports exactly what Jim is talking about. And then if we're looking at what the administration is proposing, and they're saying, okay, we're going to move toward EELV and Falcon 9 once it gets going, again, it would be tested out with government money. EELVs are optimized, as you pointed out, not for anything to do with cost, but for reliability and schedule, just like the space shuttle, which is optimized for reliability and safety. So assuming they're going to put humans on EELVs at some point, are they going to change the optimization? So it doesn't seem to me that cost makes a whole lot of difference in any of this. And with the government, the customer, you're just shifting paying ATK or someone else, and now you're paying, you know, the right hand instead of the left hand. So it goes back in support of exactly what Jim is saying.
Well, and also let me add to that thought, and that is that, I mean, if the government is the prime customer, then it's basically a zero-sum game. And I hear all these verbiage about these so-called commercial solutions, which in my mind really aren't commercial at all. If the government is the buyer, and we talk in terms of how that is expanding the market, but the market is not expanding. It's a zero-sum game.
Well, let me try to address a couple of those things. There certainly is the, you know, with these commercial crew development programs, there certainly is a danger if they, you know, they're not run in a certain way. You do end up with, you know, systems optimized to serve only a government customer, you know, and end up potentially becoming just another, you know, government program. The challenge when you're developing this is, you know, making sure that there's the flexibility in those systems such that they meet the government's needs, but they're not designed such that they can only serve the government's need, and that the companies that are operating these systems, and that's going to be an important thing, that these systems are operated by companies and not operated by NASA. Where NASA, you know, NASA is a customer. But you know, they have the flexibility.
Jeff, the customer delineates the requirements. So you're talking about the possibility of having an enlightened customer, and maybe the government will be an enlightened customer, and they'll use these alternative systems, but let them be designed with flexibility to be used in other applications as well. Maybe that'll happen. But if the government is the prime payer, the government can set down requirements that basically preempt any kind of flexibility. So I guess my point is I'm beginning to see that I'm starting to think that there may not be as much to this so-called commercial opening as what we've been led to believe, because it sounds to me like it's a little bit of a bait and switch. You know, we're using new words, we're using new buzzwords, but it's still basically, when you get right down to it, it's the same business model. And that is, the government is the customer.
Well, the contracts used are different models. That is one element that's for sure.
Yeah, that is definitely the case. That, you know, these are different contracting mechanisms, and there is also the assumption, and certainly is the case with the COTS cargo program, that the government was not paying the full price of the development of these systems. That, you know, the phrase that was used by Mike Griffin, the NASA administrator at the time, when he was introducing the concept was that they would have skin in the game. That they would be putting some money into these systems on their own, the companies developing these systems, and have, you know, a stake in their development, but that, you know, as a result, that they would have more flexibility with these systems to find additional applications as opposed to a standard government cost plus procurement system.
Let me do one question, and then we'll take a break and come back to the other questions, okay?
Okay.
That'll give us a break at about the top of the hour. Trent is with us in Australia, and he says, what do you think the overall effect of spacecraft servicing missions, either robotic or human, will be on the launch market?
It's a very interesting question about spacecraft servicing. It's a topic that's starting to get some renewed attention recently. In fact, there was a spacecraft servicing conference organized by NASA Goddard just a few weeks ago to look at the state of the technology in that. And there is the potential, if you have the ability to repair a satellite or refuel a satellite, that you can extend the life of a spacecraft and therefore delay the need to launch a replacement, particularly in the commercial communication satellite realm, and thus potentially diminish the demand for launches as a result. I think it's a little early to see exactly how that plays out, but you can certainly see scenarios where something like that does happen, where if you have the ability to, through spacecraft servicing, to extend the life of a spacecraft and therefore delay the launch of the replacement, you end up diminishing some demand for launches. Of course, for a lot of these servicing payloads, you may end up, creating demand for launches in order to launch these servicing platforms, or for launching the propellants that they need to, say, refuel these spacecraft to extend their lives. So, you may see more of a demand in a different direction for launches as a result. I think it has the potential to have an impact on the industry, but it's an open question about how big that will be or even in what direction.
Let's, Jim, do you have anything else, or otherwise we'll take our break right here?
Well, just to kind of be devil's advocate on the spacecraft servicing model, the technology changes so rapidly that even if you can service a satellite that's already in orbit, you may be better off from an economic standpoint scrapping that satellite and putting up whole new technology. You can repair an old car, but only for so long. So there's a flip side to the satellite servicing approach, is all I'm saying.
Any comment on that, Jeff?
No, and that's definitely a very good point in terms of for a lot of customers, particularly communication satellite customers, by the time their spacecraft reaches the end of its life after 15 or 17 years, they're ready to replace it with a satellite that's got more or a different number of transponders on it to meet the demands of the communications industry. There are, though, there are going to be some fraction of customers who may be interested in that in order to eke out a few additional years in life of a spacecraft to avoid launch and replacement in some cases. The question also is going to be, how does that work from a cost standpoint? How expensive will it be to service a satellite versus building and launching a replacement? In some scenarios, it may make financial sense. In others, it may not.
And won't it also increase the cost of the design of the original satellite, because it'll have to be designed from the get-go to be serviceable?
It depends on how you decide to service it and how you decide to extend the life. I know there have been proposals over the years to extend the life of spacecraft by simply, latching onto them with a payload that can provide the guidance and attitude control to take care of that. So you can extend the life of a spacecraft without having it designed from the beginning to be clearly serviceable. But if you want to do more complex applications, more complex servicing applications, then yes, you have to design in some of those standards and interfaces from the beginning.
Trent sent in a follow-up to his question, and he said the commercial had a meaning in 1990 and that the people argued about it back then too, which resulted ultimately in the EELV fleet. So I don't know if either of you want to comment on that or not, but I wanted to put it out there from him.
Yeah, well, the ELV, has a, a very interesting history in that, very briefly, in the late 90s, the Defense Department decided to support the development of two vehicles, the Atlas V and Delta IV, thinking that there would be sufficient commercial demand from communication satellite launches that you could support, the both vehicle families with the combination of commercial and government missions. Now, that commercial demand didn't materialize because of because of a number of factors, including the collapse of a lot of the proposed constellations of satellites that were going to follow on in the wake of Iridium and Globalstar and the like. So therefore, that demand didn't materialize, and it became a mostly government market for those launch vehicles, which led us down the road eventually to the formation of the United Launch Alliance to try and create cost savings to the government by, merging the Atlas V and Delta IV operations into a single entity. So that is certainly a cautionary note to keep in mind when looking at some of these potential new commercial markets.
Let's take our break, and we'll come back. We have more of your questions, and I believe Dr. Jurist has joined us. So hello, John. How are you?
Just fine, thank you.
Ah, see, he has joined us. Back in 2 minutes, everybody.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with the Space Show. Your support of the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support the Space Show button. Your contribution will help the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to the Space Show is tax deductible.
The mission of the Space Show is to promote future economic opportunities, scientific discoveries, and medical advances for all humankind through peaceful and cooperative ventures in outer space. The Space Show intends to be the forum by which space exploration becomes an integral part of our culture, our economy, our country, our world, and our global vision, in which all nations unite in creating a thriving future through the enormous potentials afforded by off-Earth opportunities. The Space Show is committed to advancing integrity and responsibility, both in our off-Earth conduct and in the potential long-range consequences of our actions in space. The Space Show wants to make the dreams of space today the realities of tomorrow.
And welcome back, everybody, to the classroom on launch vehicles, new space capabilities. Our guest panelist is Dr. Jeff Faust, and both of our co-hosts are with us, Dr. Jim Logan and Dr. John Jurist. So, Jeff, this question is from Joe in Houston, or actually anybody can respond to it. The lessons learned from the Exxon Valdez was that Exxon owned and operated their own oil tanker. They got sued and lost. Of course, they had a drunk captain, if I recall. After that unfortunate mishap, companies such as Exxon no longer own any oil tankers. Instead, a series of small offshore companies with a limited number of assets and employees own the oil tanker separately. So when another accident occurs, the owner of the responsible small offshore company disappears overnight, and the attorneys can't sue the recipients of the oil, i.e. a company such as Exxon. How do you see the same business case developing with new and relatively small manned rocket launch service companies?
Yeah, well, I'm not familiar with how the oil tanker business is structured. One important difference that I can think of off the top of my head is the fact that there is under the Outer Space Treaty of 1967, the launching states are responsible for their activities in space. and that's usually governed, particularly in the case in the U.S., through a licensing regime. In order to launch a spacecraft from a U.S. site or on a U.S. vehicle, you have to get a launch license. Those launch licenses are provided by the FAA, their Office of Commercial Space Transportation. And you have to go through a process to get that license, including, you know, demonstrating financial responsibility, and, you know, having the ability to cover, you know, the, what's called the maximum probable loss in the event of an accident. And, you know, ensuring that you have the insurance or other financial resources, it's almost always insurance, in order to do so. So you certainly have a difference in that regime there, so that if there is an accident, particularly one that causes, harm to third parties that aren't involved in the launch at all, that there is some financial responsibility in place through the licensing system in order to cover that. So in that case, you've got, it's much more difficult to have a sort of a fly-by-night operation that can disappear in the event of an accident. Of course, now if a company does have a major launch accident, there'll certainly be the question of whether they can continue as a going concern, in the long term because of the accident and the impact it's going to have on the company. But it's very difficult to sort of disappear and have no one around to be able to recoup the losses from, in that case.
Well, then the liability convention would also, doesn't it assign liability to the launching party and launching state no matter what?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, this is all codified through the Outer Space Treaty and related treaties that, were set up fairly early on in the space age. And the countries that are signatories, in case of the Outer Space Treaty, pretty much every major space-faring country is a signatory, has their own mechanisms. In the case of the U.S., it's through a licensing regime to be able to meet their treaty obligations.
Yeah, and to get a launch license, the government's going to require you meet certain liability and insurance and maximum loss provisions and stuff like that. It'd be pretty hard for a shell company to do it, in my opinion. But I'm not a lawyer.
This is John. My comment would be directed at both Jeff and David. There was some discussion some time ago that spaceflight participants, which was a special category defined by AST for early stage passengers and suborbital flights, would be considered as part of the vehicle program and potentially could end up sharing some liability with the launch company. And David, do you recall some of those discussions and what the consensus was?
Well, I mean, all of the knowledgeable, informed space attorneys that I have had the opportunity to interview that know anything about informed consent laws in any related industry all say that the fact that they were not identified legally as a passenger, which implies certain rights and privileges under the law, but were participants, they are right up there in liability with the company. So the real truth is a very wealthy person who did not protect themselves somehow in shielding liability could have more net worth than the launch company taking them up on the suborbital joyride. So in the case of an accident or injury or something happening, they could be sued right along with them. And if the courts decided this was joint and several liability, the company could go under and the person who has really high net worth and assets could be on the line for all of the risk. And so I've heard that from almost every space attorney I've ever interviewed that knows anything about spaceflight participants in law, and they really urge people to consult knowledgeable attorneys on informed consent and protecting on joint and several liability before signing the contracts, and if you do it, to make sure that you protect your own estate somehow. But remember, if you are seen as forming entities to deliberately avoid liability, the court will pierce that. So however you do it, you can't be seen as intentionally trying to subvert liability laws because that doesn't play well in our judicial system. I'm not a lawyer, so I can't really, you know, give any expert opinion on. All I can repeat is what's on archives, you know, going back many different years. Jeff, you may know more about it than I do.
Well, I'm not a lawyer either, so I'm going to decline providing a legal opinion on something like that because I'm not familiar with all the intricacies of liability law as it might apply here.
I would just urge people who want to do it to really make sure you use a very good and experienced lawyer to protect you and your family, and that's just common business advice, you know, on anything. So follow it. John, does that answer your question?
I think so. But I think it's a really important point that needs to be brought out, particularly with the proposed suborbital joyride industry.
Well, let's talk about new space potential for contributing to the launch industry. Jeff, how do you see it? I mean, we've got the companies doing lunar lander type vehicles. We've got companies working really hard to do suborbital tourism. There are a couple that claim they're going to do orbital tourism. How do you see, you know, the new space launch industry shaping up?
Well, you look at what's going on out there, and you're seeing, at least for several companies, some very positive signs of progress, particularly in the suborbital realm. You know, Virgin Galactic's now starting to do flight tests of White Knight 2 and Spaceship 2. They did the first Capis Carry flight a couple of weeks ago with that. X-Corps seems to be making some good progress with their Lynx vehicle. Mass and Space is doing development of their XA series of vertical takeoff and landing vehicles. You've got, who knows what Blue Origin's up to right now, but they seem to be up to something, and their secretive West Texas facility. You've got Armadillo Aerospace out there. You've got several companies that have, demonstrated technical capabilities that appear to have, financial resources to continue development and are making progress. Things aren't going nearly as fast as we thought it was going to be a few years ago, particularly in those heady days after Scale Composites won X Prize back in 2004, when it seemed like suborbital space tourism was literally right around the corner because we had a vehicle actually flying and doing suborbital flights. It's, I think, one of those cases where, the old saying about how we tend to overestimate what's possible in the short term but underestimate what's possible in the long term. Certainly in the short term, things that have taken longer to development, and there have been setbacks in some cases. But we're seeing progress here, and I think we're starting to see more positive signs that in a couple of years or so, that we're going to have vehicles actually starting to enter commercial service for flying tourists and or unmanned payloads for scientific research or other applications to do so. Now, a couple of years ago, you might have said the same thing, but we're seeing enough progress now by enough companies so that even if one company fails, there are plenty of other companies out there that are continuing to make progress. So I'm cautiously optimistic that we're going to see a commercial suborbital industry really start to thrive in the next few years with one or more companies providing again for either tourism and or research flights in this area.
Jim, are we seeing any kind of a cultural shift or perspective change on how new space companies, especially those trying to get into the launch industry, are perceived at Johnson or in NASA? Can you tell us anything about that?
Well, I'm probably not really the one to talk to because I tend to have a little bit different perspective than maybe most of the people here. I think there's some general excitement about the commercial launch industry and new space because what seems is kind of the water rising and floating every boat. But beyond that, I think it's also fair to say, and this is just my opinion, I'm not saying this is fact, you know, NASA and people at NASA view space as kind of their territory. And so, you know, they probably are a little ambivalent about it, about somebody else kind of getting into the act. And that might be a little unfair to say, but that's just my sense from being here.
Probably something we've all experienced and all seen. Guys, we have a phone call. Let's see who's with us. Caller, are you with us, please?
Yes.
And you are?
I'm John from Atlanta.
Welcome. How you doing?
I'm just fine.
You write really long emails. You know that?
Sometimes, yeah.
Go ahead, John.
On the issue that you were discussing earlier about, it seems like there's a lack of potential business at times that's kind of holding things back on the commercial space. It occurred to me, the discussion here of the topic of space manufacturing is a potential thing that could greatly expand the demand for launch. Years ago, they were talking about the idea that the vacuum and the weightless environment would facilitate certain exotic manufacturing processes. I wonder if anybody have any thoughts on that and how that could develop.
Jeff?
I think one of the things that really held back space manufacturing is that it is a question of the high cost to get something up there and to get it back. You know, for a lot of the manufacturing or research applications, it's the space access, the quantity and cost of which has really held things back in order to do anything with the high enough levels. And you know, we're starting to see, I think, a little bit of renewed interest in at least doing some things like biotech research and potentially materials research on facilities like the space station. You know, that there's potentially enhanced market now of doing some of the basic research to test out, some of the, of what if you're going to do something on a commercial basis to be able to first do the R&D in orbit to ensure that, you know, this makes sense and can be done on a cost competitive basis. And of course, one of the challenges for any sort of ISS research also is getting stuff up there and back, particularly once the shuttle is retired. It's just something that hasn't quite panned out like people might have thought back in the 1970s and 1980s. And it's not, I don't think, going to be necessarily a driver for launch demand in the near to the medium term. Perhaps as some of the research gets accelerated with the access to space station, and perhaps also Dragon Lab and Bigelow facilities and such, we may see that some of that research starts to transition into more commercial applications down the road, but I certainly don't see that happening anytime soon, simply because of the business case needed to make that investment.
Anyone else want to comment on that?
Well, this is John. Jeff, do you see the space biosciences being limited so much by launch and potentially recovery costs of their experiments or by the lack of predictability in getting a launch up there so that you put together an experiment that may go in a month or it may go in 3 years?
Yeah, that latter has also been a challenge for any user of space station is of not knowing when your experiment is going to fly. And certainly it's tough to build a business case for a commercial venture if you're not certain about access to and from space station. You know, the ability to, it's going to depend, I think, on some of the applications about how important it is to get stuff back as opposed to simply being able to transmit the data from experiments back. But certainly one of the big challenges once the shuttle is retired is that you're going to have, you know, a number of ways to get cargo to the space station. You fly it on a Progress, you fly it on the European ATV, you fly it on the Japanese HTV. You'll have Dragon and Cygnus if those commercial programs are successful in entering service in the next couple of years. It's going to be tough, though, to get stuff back because Progress, ATV, HTV, and Cygnus are not designed to return cargo from the space station back to Earth. They're designed to do destructive reentry. You throw the garbage that collects on the space station into them, undock and have them reenter, you know, over some desolate area like the South Pacific. Dragon will have the ability to return cargo back. Obviously, Soyuz has the ability because it's a crewed vehicle, but there's very little room in the Soyuz capsules for anything other than the returning astronauts. It's a handful of kilograms of down mass. So that's going to be an obstacle for research in the future, is for anything that requires experiments or the results of experiments to be brought back to Earth, is that there will be limited options for doing so. And if something happens with Dragon and it really would exacerbate the situation, so you may see more of a focus on either very small experiments that are easier to be returned, or experiments that require only the return of data as opposed to the samples. That's something that may be an obstacle towards greater utilization from the research community or even from commercial customers from space station if you need to get stuff back and there are limited options for doing so.
You know, along these lines, a couple of years ago, my guest on the show was Dr. Larry DeLuca, who did a lot of protein crystal growth. And he was specifically on the show because he had found the cystic fibrosis proton communicator, whatever, CFT is what I think it's called, by growing those up on the space shuttle. And he said back at the time, he said, look, price is not the problem. The problem, the pharmaceuticals would pay the price. The problem is they need reliable and routine transportation up to and from wherever they're doing the protein crystal growth, but they need to bring it back. And the problem is that it can't take heavy G's coming back or it'll destroy what you've done on orbit. And so there aren't very many options for getting anything back that both keeps it cool and minimizes the G-force upon reentry. So they needed the space shuttle, but the shuttle wasn't reliable. They weren't even objecting to the price of the shuttle. They wanted routine up and down capability with minimum G-force coming back down, and the lack of that kept that market from being a commercial market. So I think what Jeff is saying about needing that up and down and how important that is, and then if you're actually manufacturing something up there that has mass and you're going to both carry it up and carry it down, you've got some real constraints on the commercial business case for that product that you're going to make up there. Anyone else on that one? Going once? on Jeff?
Well, I think there's that's further evidence of the kind of the inelasticity of the demand. You know, talking about how the pharmaceutical companies are willing to pay the price as long as they get the kind of capability that they want.
You know, in a couple of weeks, Henry Hertzfeld is going to come on, and we're going to look at the global launch market. But, Jeff, let's assume, or either of you, anyone who wants to talk on this, that we really do get reasonable, meaningful, and efficient ITAR reform in the Obama administration. There's a lot of talk about it. There seems to be a lot of people really moving to make ITAR reform happen. And all of a sudden, it's much more competitive to use a foreign launcher than what it is right now because of the ITAR problem, and it's especially more competitive if you're a smaller company without cadres of attorneys and money set aside, you know, for legal and administrative costs to go through the ITAR process. What does this do to the U.S. domestic launch market?
Well, you know, if you look at who's using the U.S. domestic launch market right now, it's primarily, you know, government customers, NASA and the Defense Department. They're not suddenly going to be launching their satellites on Russian or Chinese vehicles if there's ITAR reform. You know, ITAR reform is really a much bigger help to the satellite side of the industry than it is. It's going to have a much bigger impact to the satellite manufacturing industry, both the prime contractors and the component suppliers, than it does to the launch industry, because there are lots of other policy and regulatory roadblocks on the launch side. I think ITAR reform has a much bigger impact for the satellite manufacturers, because it's much more difficult for them to export their satellites for launch elsewhere. The customers simply go and buy, say, a European satellite.
What about the new space industry? Does it help them? Does it open up new markets for them?
Yeah, I don't know how big of an impact it's going to have on new space in terms of opening new markets. I think one issue that's a potential hindrance that needs to be addressed is if you're doing something like suborbital space tourism, you need to be able to provide the spaceflight participants, the people who are paying to fly on the vehicles, you know, some training in order to be able to fly safely, and part of that is probably going to involve some discussion of technical information about the vehicle. If they are non-U.S. Citizens, then the question arises: do you have to go through the export control process in order to get an agreement with each one of those potential people in order to discuss that technical information? And that's actually a question that Bigelow Aerospace raised and went and have talked with the appropriate regulators about, and I'm sure it's something that the other and that suborbital vehicle providers are looking at as well, because you could see it being a potentially onerous situation if you have to get the technical assistance agreement, technical interchange agreement, to be able to do the equivalent of, you know, in case of a loss of pressure in cabin, oxygen mask will drop from the ceiling, sort of briefing for these potential customers. So if export control reform can make it less likely or unlikely that you have to do that process as a part of a regular routine safety briefing, that's certainly going to be a benefit for that particular industry. I don't know if beyond that you'll see a lot of obvious major changes, but I think in general, in sort of export reform in general, doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to have all of a sudden have a lot of business leave U.S. launchers and go to foreign launchers, because a lot of the business going to U.S. launchers is already U.S. government business that's captive, in effect, to the U.S. and to the U.S. launch industry.
Joe sent in a follow-up question. Thanks, guys, for answering my question on the show. I've enjoyed your responses. Here is yet another burning question that should get a response from your guest. Who do you believe is going to first discover the intermittent partial gravity exposure remedy? This is actually for the human factors course coming up, for bone loss on vertebrae animals, NASA, ISS, or a commercial orbiting habitat? Thanks, as always, Joe in Houston. It's a little premature for the human factors class, but first of all, there's an assumption that there is going to be a discovery of a partial gravity remedy. So I think that, number one, that's a huge assumption on its own, but I'll defer to the two doctors.
Well, I'll take a swing at it. It's an excellent question, by the way. And a lot of it depends on what kind of animal you're talking about. If it's a small animal, like a mouse or a rat, then that could conceivably be done on the space station. If you're talking about something larger, the space station is really not equipped to really do that. I'm much more interested in a 24/7 environment that will test certain gravity levels. And I think we stated before that the first one I'd be interested in, of course, is 0.38.
If you'd like to make a call, please hang up and try again. If you need help, hang up and then.
I lost Jeff.
No, I'm here.
No, you're here. Okay. So who did I lose? Oh, I know what happened. John was still on hold. Okay. Caller John, I apologize for that. Okay. And Jurist, you're still on, right?
I am.
Okay. So everybody is still with us. That was my fault, listeners. Okay. Go ahead, Jim. I apologize. Jim? Hello? Jim? What happened here?
Sounds like you lost Jim.
Well, but he's on the freeconference.com line. Jim, are you there? Did we lose Jim?
Sounds like it.
Well, he has to call back, so I don't know if he's hearing us. John, while we're waiting for him to call back, what do you have to say about the Parseval? Yeah.
My thought would be, first of all, my own preference is to answer those questions for people, because you can do the animal experiments, but until you have some assurance that the animal models are valid, they're of somewhat limited use. The second thing is the final solution, if you will, and I'm speculating totally here now, I think will be related to something that has yet to come along in understanding of bone biology. For example, there are ways of influencing bone growth with pulsating electric or pulsating magnetic fields, and I think something along those lines will probably end up being a better approach in the long run than trying to do some sort of pharmacological intervention or using some kind of a drug. Right now, the big drug for dealing with osteoporosis and aging is a class of chemicals called bisphosphonates, and they are useful in relatively short term, but when given in over periods of years, their effect is seriously abated. So I don't think that they will prove to be all that helpful for very long-term human spaceflight, but I think something related perhaps to the affecting cell maturation and growth with magnetic or electric fields may ultimately prove to be useful in the future, but that's all speculation at this point.
Jim is back with us. Are you there, Jim?
Yeah, I am. I got cut off. I don't know why. Maybe the gods didn't like what I was saying.
Maybe, but so you would rather do 24/7 environment, and that's when we got cut off.
Well, and the reason I'd rather do a 24/7 environment is because, I mean, gravity isn't a small-scale countermeasure. I don't think we're going to find a solution whereby which you climb into a small-arm centrifuge and get spun around for 90 minutes, and then that's your fix. I think the fix is going to be gravity, you know, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And to test that hypothesis, we're going to need a much larger system. So, you know, the ISS is not configured to do that.
Well, is Bigelow going to be configured? Because that was the alternative. Or does it have to be a commercial orbiting, specially made habitat to put a huge centrifuge up there?
Well, I don't think it has to be a huge centrifuge. You could do it with either a HAB module with a counterweight on the other end and do it with tethers, or you could do two modules on each end of a tether and rotate them end over end to the G level that you wanted to evaluate.
Any chance of any of this happening in a reasonable amount of time?
Well, yes, but it depends on the vision. I mean, it depends on what priority you place on that. And I think that if we're going to go anywhere beyond Earth orbit, Mars, Martian moons, near-Earth asteroids, depending on how far away they might be and how long it takes to get there and back, I think we're going to have some kind of artificial gravity. We just don't know what kind. We don't know the gravity prescription yet. We don't know the dose, we don't know the frequency, and we don't know the side effects. And there will be side effects from pseudo-gravity by rotation. There will be side effects.
Do you think they could do surgery? Could they do surgery in artificial gravity?
Yes, but they can also do surgery in zero gravity.
Really, how do you contain blood and stuff like that in zero gravity surgery?
Well, funny you should ask. We actually did some work on the Vomit Comet in the 1980s, and there are three kinds of bleeders that you have to deal with. One is just capillary bleeding, one is venous bleeding, and one is arterial bleeding. For the capillary bleeding, the blood basically just follows the surface tension of the tissues. So you basically mop that up the same way you do it in an operating theater here on the ground for the most part. Venous blood tends to just form a sphere. So it doesn't move to the dependent part of the operative field or to the dependent part of the wound. It just sits there and gets bigger. And you can take a sucker tip and touch that sphere of blood, and it'll just disappear in front of your eyes. And then with arterial bleeding, if you get a spurt, it just keeps going until it hits something. And so we actually tested some large umbrella devices that were padded on the underside with absorbent material, and we were able to do just fine. Now, this was simulated surgery. I want to point that out because, believe it or not, there were all kinds of animal rights, political-type concerns, even on the KC-135. So we never did, at least to my knowledge, any real surgery on the Vomit Comet. It was all simulated.
Jim, this is John. Weren't there some experiments on the relative workload in doing simple tasks, such as even suturing, that showed that it's a little harder to restrain in zero-G to suture and create a neat suture line?
Well, it takes
I seem to recall some of that.
Well, it takes a little longer, but Dr. Bruce Houchins, who at that time was at University of Texas, he was the deputy department head at the University of Texas Health Science Center. He was a former Marine fighter pilot and very interested in the space environment. And he and I designed a restraint system to do minor surgery on animals. And we actually tested that in the KC-135. I still have pictures. The picture's really interesting because I was actually young in those days. So the pictures are kind of fun to look at. But it really wasn't as hard as you think. We had loops to put your feet in, and we wore a belt, and you could move up to the operating table and basically attach this belt by a special belt buckle to the edge of the table. And it gave you a lot of freedom of motion, especially in zero G. So it really wasn't that much of a problem.
We'll move off of this back to the launch industry, but Joe sent in a follow-up, and by the way, I think he works in NASA. I forget exactly what he did or what he does, but he said the deputy ISS program manager told me face-to-face a month ago that two long-duration astronauts had returned to Earth showing no bone loss. Any comments?
Well, I haven't heard that. And I can also tell you that when we started using kind of improved technology to look at our bone loss, and that is spiral CT, we found that the rate of bone loss was twice what we thought it was just using, standard bone demineralization X-ray techniques. So, no, I don't think that's an accurate statement based on what I know.
Jeff, do you have any comments on this? Otherwise, I'm going to move on and go back to rockets.
No, it's a little outside my area of expertise. It's been an interesting discussion nonetheless.
Trent says, we're not getting away from artificial gravity. We opened up a can of worms. Why isn't artificial gravity listed as a possible flagship technology demonstration?
Well, I'm assuming this is a reference to some of the technology demonstrations that NASA is talking about doing under the new exploration plan that it announced a couple of months ago.
Yeah, that's my assumption, too.
Yeah, so I don't know why artificial gravity isn't listed there. It's certainly possible that it may be added at some point, particularly keeping in mind that, you know, they're still fleshing out a lot of the details of this new technology demonstration program, assuming that it does get funded as the budget works its way through Congress in the coming months. And there may be opportunities to put in, if not at the flagship level, but elsewhere, some sort of artificial gravity demonstration programs somewhere along the line, if it's deemed critical towards future exploration. And there's going to be a broad technology roadmap process to look at the various technologies that they need wherever we end up going, Moon, Mars, asteroids, wherever the case may be. So even though if it's not explicitly listed now in the FY11 budget proposal documents that came out a couple months ago, I don't necessarily mean that it's ruled out for consideration at a later date.
Jim, do you know why it wouldn't have been listed as a demonstrator?
I just don't think there's all that, quite frankly, I don't think there's all that much enthusiasm to really look at it.
But they can't go anyplace without looking at it, so there seems to be a disconnect.
That's what I keep telling them. But
draw whatever conclusion you want. Yeah.
Are you the only one down there at Johnson advocating this?
No. Look, I can remember the days in the 1980s where you could get fired for even mentioning the words artificial gravity. So there is an apparent, and of course I'm just going on my perspective, kind of an institutional denial, and I think part of the reason for that is that it's difficult to do. And so there's not as much resistance to, a very small centrifuge, or even to a small arm centrifuge. I mean, there were plans for a small arm centrifuge that actually progressed, progressed quite a ways, but eventually it was canceled too.
Well, do you know if any other? What about another human spaceflight nation picking up and doing this? They face the same problem. So, do you ever see anything out of ESA, Russia, China, any place, talking about this?
No, but I fully expect that whoever wants to go beyond Earth orbit is going to have to tackle this question, along with radiation protection. Those are the two that the engineers seem particularly allergic to.
Understatement.
Let me throw in the last, it'll probably be the last question. We saved the longest from last, and this is Andy's question from London, which I sent all of you in advance. So let me see if I can quickly read it for the benefit of listeners. Can any of you discuss how commercial crew launch to LEO might fit into a NASA exploration architecture? Buzz Aldrin's recent exploration vehicle concept comes to mind when NASA would design a deep spacecraft that remained permanently in space and commercial craft would ferry astronauts to it. Also, why do most commercial companies appear to favor capsules rather than the mini shuttle approach like the SpaceDev Dream Chaser? Is it safety, cost, weight, or simplicity, or perhaps a combination of all of these? And then finally, most people will see a capsule as a backward step as they have become used to seeing the orbiters land on a runway. It would have been harder to label Constellation Apollo on steroids if a mini shuttle had been used to ferry to LEO to an awaiting vehicle. It would also have meant that the NASA would have had a ready-made ISS crew transport and be able to cope with more down mass and what you've been talking about. So anyone want to comment on capsules, exploration architecture, et cetera?
Yeah, let me start at least with the first part of that question, was the role of commercial crew in exploration. I certainly think that, and I think what NASA's intent is,
for the commercial crew program is to have these, you know, the commercial providers that can ferry crews to the space station would also be able to ferry crews to whatever staging they create in low Earth orbit for missions to the moon or near Earth asteroids or eventually to Mars, you know, in much the same way that we use you know, commercial aviation today to get to, say, a staging area. You know, if you're going to go to Antarctica, you may fly commercially to, say, New Zealand and then pick up a government transport to fly down to the South Pole. Or if you're, you know, a soldier going to Afghanistan, you may fly commercially to a staging area in the U.S. or Europe or someplace else and then pick up the military transport for the last stage of that flight. I think you may see something similar on the exploration program where you fly a commercial vehicle to low Earth orbit and then pick up the, you know, the government-specific exploration vehicle, whatever that may be, for that mission beyond low Earth orbit. For the question about capsule versus, you know, wing bodies, capsules, I think, are simpler to do. They're fairly well understood. They are... you know, much more efficient in terms of the mass than a winged vehicle that's going to have a lot of features like the wings and stabilizer and so on that are needed only for the reentry process. So I think that's why you see a lot of the commercial ventures, at least starting off, you know, for their initial generations of vehicles with a relatively straightforward, well-understood capsule approach to minimize the technical risk for that vehicle development. It doesn't rule out that at some point, you know, they may move on to a winged vehicle if there is enough advantages, you know, and reasons for doing so down the road. But I, you know, from the standpoint of something that's well understood and relatively straightforward to develop and efficient, you know, capsules may look backwards in some respects, but they work.
Anyone else want to say anything about that? As I told Larry in an email, so for listeners, I did an interview, not Larry, Andy, excuse me. I did an interview with Larry Price in Pasadena at AIAA 2009, so it would have been middle September 2009, and he's the CEO of the Lockheed Orion project. And I asked him extensively about why a capsule versus a winged vehicle or some other, you know, type of shape. So if you really want to hear what he had to say, he goes into the engineering of it. Yes, he's talking about Orion and not Orion Light, but he put in the trade-offs for winged vehicle and capsule and really went through them in some detail. So if you want a comprehensive discussion on it, go back and listen to that September 2009 show with Lawrence Price of Lockheed, CEO of Orion. I'm sorry, I don't have the date for it. Okay, guys, we're coming up toward the end. So this is a question from Sandra in Reno, Nevada. Why is it you haven't talked about serious potential launchers that could really change the market? So Space Elevator comes to mind, the nuclear rocket comes to mind, and even the new budget proposal seems to have money in it for Vasimir. What's your assessment of these potential, maybe probable launch systems?
Well, some of those are really in-space propulsion technologies, like Vasimir, like some of the nuclear propulsion technologies that may turn out to be essential for doing deep space exploration. You know, the NASA Administrator Charles Bolden has talked a number of times in the last couple of months about the need to greatly reduce the travel time for human exploration of Mars, for example, to minimize things like radiation exposure and zero-G exposure. And so technologies like that may prove essential. They don't solve, though, the problem of getting off the surface of the Earth and getting into low Earth orbit. So we're still looking at more conventional technologies. Space elevator is, you know, the concept is intriguing of the space elevator to do that, but there are a huge number of technical issues, business issues, legal and regulatory issues associated with trying to develop anything like that. So it's an attractive concept, but it's not a near-term solution to our space access issues.
And they're not necessarily a let's lower the launch cost solution either, are they?
Well, I think, you know, the space elevator people would say that, you know, it certainly would be a much lower cost, at least on a per unit time. It's the question of how much it costs to develop it and how you amortize the cost of doing that to see exactly how much it would cost to do something like that. But I think if you look at that and you look at the various obstacles required to develop something like that, that is a much longer term solution. It may turn out, you know, in 50 or 100 years, we'll look back and say, well, that's obviously the way you do it. You don't light rockets to put things into orbit. But right now, that's the technology we're stuck with, and it's a good enough technology for now. And you know, I think there's a lot that we can do to make improvements in terms of the operations and development of chemical rockets that can do a lot to potentially lower prices of space access. That's certainly the approach SpaceX is taking, while maintaining reliability and related issues, while we devote, you know, some research and development efforts to, you know, sort of long-range approaches, be it the space elevator or anything else people have in mind, that could provide much more revolutionary advancements in terms of space access. But for the near term, I think, you know, for better or worse, we've got chemical rockets and that's the way that we're going to be accessing space for many years to come.
You know, I think we'd be remiss if we didn't at least mention briefly, which is basically all the time we have left, now that we're talking about potential rockets, there are other considerations that are talked about that we hear all the time on the media and in the blogs and wherever else we turn. One is the direct concept, and another is heavy lift, like Ares-5 or Ares-5 Light. And then, of course, Constellation in general, including Ares-1. Jeff, any assessment of these programs? A couple of them are still on paper, direct and heavy lift. Ares-1, you know, is largely built in some form of the test process. How do you see these rockets coming into being or not coming into being?
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, the prospects for Ares 1 right now obviously don't look good if the budget proposal, you know, survives the congressional gauntlet in the months to come. You know, and I think, you know, you may see, you know, there's a lot of discussion right now about changes to the plan and potential compromises. But those compromises seem to be focused more on salvaging the Orion spacecraft more than the Ares launch vehicle. So, you know, it's possible that at the end Congress may, you know, have enough support for Ares to continue funding for that and sort of, you know, push that down NASA and the White House's throats in that respect. But you know, right now the prospects don't look terribly good.
Heavy lift and direct.
You know, heavy lift in general, whether it's a direct concept or Ares-5 or some of the shuttle derived, the shuttle side mount approaches and so on. You know, the question is how do those fit into the broader exploration architecture? Because while you can talk about potential other applications for heavy lift, you really have to develop heavy lift. Exploration would be the primary driver for developing heavy lift. There's not a commercial demand right now saying we need to be able to put 100 tons in low Earth orbit. There's not a military requirement to put 100 tons in the low Earth orbit. There may be potential ancillary uses along those lines in the years to come if the capability was developed to serve an exploration mission.
But it's not going to be developed otherwise. So the question is, how does heavy lift fit into whatever exploration architecture that you need? And I know there's been a lot of debate about that. And what the new plan seems to be doing is saying, well, we'll develop various technologies that can enable heavy lift, such as development of a new rocket engine. That could support a heavy lift launch vehicle capability and sort of push that decision down the road, because under this new plan there is not going to be the same urgency for heavy lift development as there was in the Constellation. So if you're looking at any sort of decision on the various trade spaces for heavy lift, the question is, what are you going to use it for? What are the mission architectures you're going to use it for? When do you need it? What is the importance of maintaining, say, the shuttle-based industrial base, be it external tanks or space shuttle main engines or solid rocket motors, versus taking a more clean sheet approach, or taking an approach that's derived from the ELV launch vehicles? There are various concepts out there for scaling up the Atlas V and Delta IV vehicles to launch much heavier payloads than they can do right now. How heavy is heavy lift is another question that really needs to be addressed, in terms of, you know, how much payload do you need to be able to put up at a single time versus being able to launch more launches of smaller payloads and do things like on-orbit assembly, or doing things like propellant depots and launching large numbers of smaller rockets and getting cost efficiencies in that way, develop propellant depots because propellant is often one of the major sources of mass for any sort of exploration architecture, in terms of the propellant needed to get out of low Earth orbit to go to the moon or someplace else. So there's a big trade space there that really needs to be addressed, and it seems to be what the new plan is taking a step back and saying, you know, we're gonna push that decision a little farther down the road than simply continuing with Ares 5. The issue is that by doing so, you may preclude some of the options for using, say, some of the shuttle infrastructure if you decide not to utilize the shuttle infrastructure immediately after the shuttle's retired.
Anyone else want to comment on that? The last question, Joe sent in a comment and said that he thought one of my guests, and I don't remember who it was, said he had a direct line to Bill Nelson's office in Washington, and he was interested in the concept of exposing mice or rats to intermittent partial gravity on the space station to solidify space research funding. I don't remember who that guest was. I don't have any memory of it. Maybe some of you have any input or ideas on whether Nelson's office is interested in anything like that. Do you, Jeff, know if he's got an interest in that?
I don't know. I mean, one of the big advocates for ISS research in Congress has been Senator Kate Bailey Hutchison of Texas, who is she's a Republican. She's the ranking member of the full Senate Commerce Committee. So she has introduced legislation in the Senate with companion legislation in the House to ensure continued access to the space station by extending the shuttle program at a low flight rate and continuing development of commercial vehicles to make sure that there's no long-term gap in U.S. access to the space station. We'll see how that legislation fares in Congress in the months to come. But she's been a much more vocal advocate for ISS research and supporting the ability to do that in Congress than almost anyone else that I can think of. I don't think that Senator Nelson is opposed to ISS research. I think he certainly thinks, for example, extending the ISS to at least 2020 is a good idea. But he is not nearly as vocal an advocate for ISS research as Senator Hutchison has been.
Anyone want to bet on whether the shuttle gets extended to eliminate the gap while we develop commercial rockets, or whether it'll be terminated as planned?
I think you may see a modest shuttle extension. You may see a mission added. You may see a couple of missions added, something like, you know, there, there,
there's only so much that you can do in terms of extending the shuttle without having to do a fair expense of restarting production lines or external tanks and various components to do that, which does take some time to do that. And obviously you have the expense of maintaining the shuttle program at least a couple of $1 billion a year during that time, money that might otherwise go towards commercial crew or might go towards other exploration programs. I think it's unlikely that you would be able to get that additional money added onto NASA's budget on top of everything else, given the budget environment in Washington these days. That's a major challenge. If you're talking about it in a long term shuttle extension by several years, that's an issue that has to be taken into account. Is where does the money come from to do that, and who pays for that in terms of other programs within NASA? Unless you can work some sort of budgetary magic to bump up NASA's overall budget by the cost needed to extend the shuttle program.
Jim, John, any comments on that one? Listeners, well, go ahead, Jim.
I mean, I don't know quite how to say this. The shuttle, I mean, there's been a shuttle program office since 1972. The space shuttle has had a long run. And the space shuttle had some very interesting capabilities, and it was very interesting engineering. It wasn't cost effective. It was never robust. It isn't safe. And it's extremely expensive. And not cost efficient in any way, shape, or form. I'm really, quite frankly, at a loss as to why anybody would want to extend that program. There are a lot of talented people here at NASA, and they could be busy doing something that would be taking the place of shuttle. I understand the whole concept about jobs, but at some point in time, you just have to let it go. And I think that time is now. So personally, I'll be a little disappointed if it's extended.
John, nothing from you on that?
Well, I'm not going to step into that for anything in the world.
I, like a lot of people, I hate to see the gap, and I think that is a huge problem for the United States, and the shuttle's the only way to buy that gap down. But boy, $1 billion a launch, it's a lot of money.
So. And if you count the development costs, it's $1.9 billion a launch. And if you start only flying the vehicle twice a year,
probably goes up. It doubles, you said?
Well, no, it could double.
It could double.
I mean, the only reason it's as good as $1.1 or $1.9 billion a launch, depending on whether you factor in the development costs, is because it flies more than twice a year.
And we will miss that download capacity, won't we? So I'm glad I'm not the policymaker. That's all I can say. Gentlemen, we're beyond the two-hour point, so it's time to wind it up. Listeners, this show is going to be archived on the Space Show website as well as the blog, which is http://spaceshowclassroom.wordpress.com. If you have a question or comment for any of our guests, panel members, post it on the blog and we'll all check it. I'll call everybody's attention to it, and that way we can keep the classroom discussions public. If you send me a private email, it's going to be posted on the blog under your name. So don't think you can avoid being public by sending it to me private. It's going on the blog. Anybody have any last minute pearls of wisdom or closing comments you want to leave with us? Who wants to go first? John, since you joined us late, you go first.
Well, that means that I didn't know what went on for the first hour, but I think this discussion has been very interesting and instructive, and I really appreciate Jeff's taking the time to
help clarify some of these issues for us.
Absolutely. Anyone else want to offer closing comments?
Well, I think it's been a great show, and I always enjoy either talking to Jeff or reading his articles. You know, the Space Review is one of the best sources that I can think of for space news analysis.
Absolutely. www.thespacereview.com comes out every Monday. And as I said, it's a free subscription, and if you're not on his list, there's something really wrong with you if you care about space. That's all I can say. But, you know, people, go visit his other stuff, too, and some of his work from Futron Corporation. Jeff is a master contributor of very high-quality work into the space arena. So make yourself available to seeing what he has to produce and what he has to do. SpaceToday.net and SpacePolitics.com. Jeff, certainly thanks to you. I know you're getting ready to go to Space Access in Phoenix. Fly safe. Have a great trip. Enjoy yourself. I wish I was there to see everybody and all my friends. Any final comments from you tonight?
Well, I just want to extend my thanks to you, David, for the invitation to be on the show. It's always a pleasure. It's always great discussions that go on here on the show, and also I appreciate a lot the free publicity for the Space Review and the other sites. And you know, it's a very interesting time right now because we are going through the potential, at least, for something of a paradigm shift for how we view space. Space access that, you know, in sort of the best possible case, if a lot of these commercial ventures are successful, we may be opening up some new markets. We may be providing some new opportunities for lower cost and more frequent access to space. You know, there's also potential at the other end that things may not change very much. But that's what makes this time particularly interesting is seeing how these forces interact with one another, see the potential changing role of NASA being more of a customer for commercial applications, and seeing all the potential obstacles that could derail all this. So hopefully this will result in some major positive changes, but there certainly is no guarantee, and it's why it's very important to stay on top of what's going on in this field and seeing how the industry may change significantly in the years to come.
Absolutely.
We'll find out.
Absolutely. Thank you all. And one final comment for those of you who like women's basketball, UConn is the new national champion. So hope you're happy with that. And if you're a Stanford fan, you can go mourn after we get off the space show. Jeff, Jim, and John, notice that you all three have J for the – I didn't notice that before. I wonder what the significance of that is. Jeff, Jim, and John, thank you all for being on this Space Show Classroom program. Listeners, Space Policy from the Guru, not that Jeff is not the guru, but this is the Guru S. Marcia Smith is our guest Friday morning. Don't miss that program. Thank you all, and good night from all of our panel members and the Space Show.